is the Grimmian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grimmian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Grimmian Bunker, my friends, Merry Christmas to you all, and welcome to the program. It is the Grimmian Report. I'm your happy host, the mouth of the South himself, Micah Hanks, and you've locked in to the darkest corner of the web, where each week we bring you news from beyond the fringe. Yes, my friends, the future is now. Glad to be here in the moment with you yet again for the Grimmian Report. Today's date, as of this live broadcast, is December 17th in the year of our Lord, 2013. Boy, only a couple years, well, weeks left in this year. And then I'm going to be setting sail on the high seas and headed down to Mexico with David Hatcher Childress, Hugh Newman, and my good buddy Dr. Robert Schock as we probe ancient mysteries on the ancient alien cruise. It's going to be an exciting time. I'm flying solo tonight, by the way. The Grimmian gang are taking some time off for the holidays. Much deserved. You know me, though, the happy and fun-loving neighborhood Grimmian. I'm the man who never sleeps. And, of course, as the old saying goes, no rest for the wicked, right? At least, that's what Phyllis Galdi at Fate Magazine keeps telling me. I've got a nickname there at Fate, and they call me the Wicked One, because I'm obviously so wicked. I mean, you know, back in the 1990s when I was a kid, I mean, wicked meant cool, right? Yeah, so I don't know if I'm the coolest kid on the block, but I'm always glad to be here. You're fun-loving, friendly neighborhood Grimmian, nonetheless. Had a great time last night with Cam and Kyle from Expanded Perspectives doing their live broadcast, catching up with Craig Woolheater of Cryptomundo.com, as well as Mr. Nick Redfern. I told the guys, though, when they had me on as the guest, I said, you know, what you should do is don't introduce me as Micah Hanks. Introduce me as Nick Redfern's arch nemesis and call me Rick Nedfern. So anyway, salutations to everyone in the chat room. I see actually Cam and Kyle are in there. Graham from Grimerica, Quinn the Eskimo, Mr. McNonymous of Middle Theory fame, Nikki Nuvi, Scotty Roberts in there, Zadok, all kinds of fine folks. It's always good to see friendly faces participating in the live chat. One of many ways you can communicate directly with the bunker here during the live broadcast. During hour two of tonight, we're going to be communicating with a man who perhaps has communicated with those things that extend beyond the reach of the senses. And I tell you, he's going to be one of the most interesting guests you'll ever hear on this program, Soraya Ozkoth. He's a buddy of mine. He's the host of the program, Where Did the Road Go? I have been a guest on that program many times in the past, but he is he's probably going to be one of the more interesting and controversial guests. He's lived a very interesting life, and there are things that I don't even know about him that we're going to be getting into and discussing. It's going to be interesting. It'll be a wild ride, and I'm glad to have all of you along for the ride. And speaking of all of you, we've got a few listener emails that came in over the last few days. Thought we'd get to a few of those. One of my favorite guys to hear from every now and again from down under. We've got a lot of listeners in Australia. And Luke is from Australia. He writes and says, "Hi, Micah. It's strange. You know, about a week or two ago, late at night, I turned the TV on, and playing on it was a Sword in the Stone scene. So I watched and checked out the TV info shortly after it. It was Excalibur, the very film you'd mentioned recently on the program. Now, I don't think I'd seen it before, but the sword extraction scene I watched wasn't very eventful. It just kind of pulled it out really easy, and everyone was hilariously shouting their lines at each other. I watched a little of it and then moved on. So imagine my surprise when I heard last week's podcast. Now, another somewhat synchronicity was when you mentioned about VHS film covers being just as good as movies when it comes to a child's imagination. My mother worked in a video store when I was younger, and so I always was cover browsing and watched a heap of dodgy horror films over the years. I was recently given a movie by a mate, and it ended up being a movie that had one of those intriguing covers. It was called Society. It really weirded me out. I'm not familiar with that one. But he says, P.S., if anyone likes dodgy or brutal horror movies, then if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend Brain Dead, or it might be called Dead Alive over in the States. It's a film that was made by Peter Jackson, and he had done a few strange movies before he became a big shot. Now he, of course, directed the Lord of the Rings films and one of the biggest box office releases for this holiday season, The Hobbit, the second installment of The Hobbit, that is, the Desolation of Smaug. Brain Dead is probably the ultimate zombie movie, Luke says, and I dare you to watch it and eat red raspberry custard at the same time. Merry Christmas, Luke. I don't seem to recall that film right off the top of my head.
I kick ass for the Lord!
But nonetheless, I'm sure everyone out there in the radio listening audience probably knows that one. Anyway, DWL writes, "Hi, I'm a long-time listener, but a first-time writer. Well, thank you for writing. On the December 10th episode, the comment was made when discussing the Grail symbolism. Yet again, we have this Grail thing. Notice the captivation that it holds among the audience here. He said that when you were discussing Grail symbolism, it was apparently mentioned that this was absent from Eastern culture. I would just like to point out that ancient Asian tea ceremonies are a means to call out how wrong that comment was. Anyway, love the show. DWL. DW, by the way, allow me to take a sip of my tea right now.
Mm.
Delicious blend of green tea and echinacea with a touch of lemon and honey. Betty June writes, "Hey, Micah, I hope all is well in North Carolina. I was a little behind on the podcasts. I've got a couple of little puppies in their 24/7 deal. Well, I just finished up the last two shows, and I really enjoyed the last podcast. Your guest was really super. We want more like him." Actually, I guess as of when this was written, that would have been Lyle Blackburn. She says, "I want to comment on the stopped watch thing. We've been getting a lot of those reports recently as well." She says, "Before they invented battery-operated watches, I used to stop watches, too. They lasted anywhere from 3 hours to a month. Now, Rose didn't believe me when we met. I was using a pocket watch, which didn't have to touch my skin. And so I bought a Mickey Mouse watch, and within 3 weeks, it stopped. And then she was a believer. But I know I came by it naturally, because my mother couldn't wear watches either." Well, that's not true. She wore them as decorations or jewelry, although I like antique watches, and I stick to those newfangled Mickey Mouse watches today. And now that I've finished on all my Behind Grailian Report episodes, I'm going to have to move over to Middle Theory and the Micah Hanks programs to catch up. Stay warm, happy Christmas, and a merry new year. Cosmic love, Betty June." Always wonderful to hear from the Farkas family household. Jonathan Wilson took a slightly different approach with his message he sent along this week. He sent some paranormally themed jokes. And so I thought, well, you know, why just keep all this fun and frivolity to myself? I'll share these with the listeners this week. And so I now submit for your approval a few paranormally themed jokes. So let's see what you think, okay? Everybody ready? Okay, this first one is called the Ouija board. Now, two teenagers were experimenting with Ouija boards one day, and one girl asked if she could ever get married. The board answered, and it said, "Yes." Next, she asked the Ouija board, "Well, what will his name be?" And the board spelled out as clear as day, the letters T-O-M. Lastly, the girl asked, "Will I be happy with Tom?" And the board answered, "Yes." Well, it wasn't 5 years before she met a man named Tom, and sure enough, they fell in love and became married. And one day after, her husband saw his wife trying to burn a Ouija board in the fireplace, Tom asked her, "Why are you doing that?" The wife replied, "Well, I'm burning this board because it lied to me. It lied to me about our marriage." Now, Tom said, "Well, how could it have lied? You told me once that that board said that you would get married, and it said that your husband's name would be Tom." His wife replied, "Yes, but it also said I'd be happy, and therefore it lied." Hmm. Okay. Close enough. Two good friends, John and Greg, met up at a pub. Their conversation went something like this. "How are you and your family?" Well, the guy says, "Oh, we're all fine. How about yours?" "Well, we're all healthy and we have work to, you know, have to work to earn our keep. How about your son? Is he still workless, unemployed?" "Oh, no, not at all. He's doing meditation now." "Meditation? What's he doing?" "Well, I don't know exactly what it entails, but it's sure better than just sitting down and doing nothing." Hmm. That's what I was thinking, by the way. A young clairvoyant boy who could see which family member was going to die next apparently prayed one night and said, "God bless Mama, God bless Papa, and goodbye, Grandma." Well, the following day, his grandma was run over by a bus. The next day, he prayed again. And this time, he said, "God bless Mama and goodbye, Papa." Now, his dad was really worried, and he went to work very carefully that next day. But he made it through the day alive and got home and said to his wife, "You know, I I was really watching my back. I felt a little nervous, but everything seems to be okay. So glad to have made it home, honey. And he's hugging his wife, and she says, yes, 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 absolutely, but there's some disturbing news. The strangest thing happened. The milkman apparently just dropped dead today. If you have paranormal jokes you'd like to send along, those can be addressed directly to the bunker at info@graylianreport.com. You know, it's the height of the cold season here, and we are now with the supreme holiday of Christmas just a few days away, and New Year right after that. Nobody wants to get cold for the holidays, and so a lot of people tend to carry along with them. They'll carry their hand sanitizer, where they'll make frequent trips to the restroom and they'll wash their hands. Well, get this. A new study is now recommending that antibacterial soap may not actually prevent the spread of germs. Now, this, just to be clear here, this story was posted on December 17th, although it sounds almost like the kind of thing you'd expect on April 1st. You may want to think twice before squirting that hand sanitizer. The Food and Drug Administration is now saying that antibacterial soaps may not prevent the spread of germs and could even pose significant health risks. So the FDA is challenging the creators of antibacterial products to prove that they are more effective than simply washing hands with regular soap and water. Now, if companies cannot prove this, they will be required to relabel or potentially even remove their antibacterial products. First, it was labels on cigarettes, and now we're getting labels on antibacterial soap, which may not actually be antibacterial. Interesting. Now, according to a spokesperson with the Environmental Health Department, they have said that antibacterial products are approved. They've been out there on the market for quite some time, but there have been no studies that prove it's any more efficient than just good old-fashioned soap and water. The FDA does believe the risk of antibacterial soaps and body washes are greater than the benefits. What? Anyway, these risks involve the safety of certain chemicals in antibacterial soaps, including triclosan and triclocarbon. Carban, not carbun, for all you chemistry majors out there. And they're already banned in other countries. Antibacterial products do not kill germs, though, and if the two combine, it may lead to drug-resistant superbugs. The spokesperson further said that antibacterial items can, over a long term, produce a disease-resistant strain of bacteria that is an item of concern right now. So who would have thunk antibacterial products could literally cause disease-resistant strains of bacteria, according to FDA studies and other information? Very odd. So, well, maybe there are other ways that we could combat those little flu bugs this holiday season. You know, something I like to do is I turn up the volume on the intake of vitamin C supplements and, you know, things like ginseng, echinacea, garlic. Love garlic. Ah, but then there's this that came out again just today. A new study that also suggests that multivitamins may not quite be worth the money. If you take multivitamins, some researchers say, you may want to reconsider. According to three studies from the Annals of Internal Medicine, vitamin and mineral supplements don't seem to prevent disease or its progression. One study shows supplements don't decrease the risk of death, heart disease, or cancer. A second study says multivitamins don't have any effect on cognitive performance or memory in adults. The third found multivitamins don't prevent a second heart attack either. Now, researchers have also said that in some cases, supplements could even harm you. Registered dietitian Marissa Pruitt said that taking a multivitamin or mineral probably won't hurt you, but that it's not a substitute. Our body, she says, doesn't utilize a supplement the way it does actual food sources of those vitamins and minerals. And so we always want to turn to our food first. Pruitt said that if you're going to take a supplement, it shouldn't contain more than 100% of all vitamins and minerals. Interesting. But then again, would they still perhaps strengthen the immune system and ward off the typical holiday viruses and the like? Maybe so. And if you're still feeling fatigued and tired this holiday season, another thing you may want to avoid is working too much. Oh boy, I'm going to have to take my own advice now. And I worry about those energy drinks just as well. Maybe some of you heard this recent story about a copywriter in Indonesia. It was Saturday. Her name was Mita Duran, and she had posted a complaint on Twitter. 30 hours of working and still going strong, with a series of O's there in the center. And soon afterwards, she collapsed and died the following day. literally worked herself to death. The social network quickly lit up with condolences along with messages from advertising staffers urging each other not to overwork themselves and also demanding change in the industry. This is insane. No campaign is worth this. According to one Dubai-based Twitter user, adding, "We're not curing cancer, it's just advertising." Now, it wasn't immediately clear what medical issues might have precipitated Ms. Duran's death, or even if they were related to work, though some local reports blamed her long hours and heavy consumption of a Southeast Asian energy drink. But the death struck a chord, particularly since it came 7 months after a 24-year-old Ogilvy PR staffer in Beijing, Gabrielle Lee, suffered a heart attack and died at his desk. News reports quickly blamed his death on overwork, though the cause was not clear. It's unclear also whether he might have been consuming these unnamed energy drinks. But, you know, there have been concerns here in the United States about the consumption of vitamin and mineral supplement drinks, energy drinks that are supposed to give you that extra added boost. They combine caffeine with all these things, ginseng, guarana, vitamin B, God knows what, bat guano probably. And they may not necessarily promote overall health, especially if they are taken too often. I guess it just brings to mind the old saying, doesn't it, that, well, you can actually have what's, I guess, well, too much of a good thing, right? There is such a thing as too much of a good thing, no doubt. All right, and when we come back, we don't want too much of a good thing right now, so we're going to have to take a quick break. When we do return, however, we're going to be looking a little bit at the ancient mysteries of human history. In fact, a few things that may be changing a few people's minds about the origins of ancient man, and of course, where we in the modern day come from. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this.
Imagine no longer being tied down to your computer, but having the freedom to take live talk radio with you anywhere you go. TalkStream Live introduces our first ever iPhone application. The talk shows you follow now follow you, and your iPhone is now the fastest and easiest way to stay connected to the best talk radio on the internet. Let TalkStream Live transform the way you listen to radio. Listen to live talk shows 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mobile talk radio from TalkStream Live. Now available in the iTunes App Store.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. You know, I remember hearing a story just a little while ago. Many of you out there probably remember hearing this just as well. I believe it's Popular Science. They made headlines for deciding that they wanted to remove comment features on their articles that appear on their website. The reason for this was because of skeptics and detractors from conventional scientific viewpoints that continue to post on the site. And Popular Science argues that it took away from the merit of the scientific attitudes being espoused. So their response, their way of dealing with this, was quite simply to remove the ability for people to post comments at all. Now, to me, that's a sort of an odd sort of an odd response, because I think that there's a fine line that we run the risk of crossing when we talk about dismissing or removing people's ability to interact with one another in a public forum. I guess that the owner of a website or an organization or, you know, a print publication that has an online presence, they have a right to be able to turn on or moderate comments however they choose. But it is a little strange to me when the opinion is, and this is apparently their stated reason, and this is old news, but bear with me, we're going to tie this in with something that's a lot more up to date. It's strange to me that there is this attitude that, well, if someone presents a counter argument, we're worried that it makes our information that we're putting out there looking, it makes it look bad, and so we're going to take that ability away so as to preserve the integrity of the article or the idea. I mean, it's very odd because I think that open debate, discussion, freedom of speech, you know, these are all things that should be held dear. They should be virtuous. Now, granted, on the other end of the spectrum, I suppose you could say that there are people who don't know how to conduct themselves politely in public. There are those trolls that, you know, they'd apparently never listened to what Thumper said. You remember, if you can't say anything nice, then don't say anything at all. And these people have to go about being snarky, overtly rude, demeaning, demanding, even. So maybe there is a case to be made for proper comment moderation, but my God, it's such an endeavor at times to have to undertake when you have to approve or ban or you know whatever it is in order to be able to preserve a friendly, educational, and consistent conversation in an online forum. Now, you know, I'll tell you this, at Graylian Report, knocking on wood as I say this, Graylian Report, we've never ever had that issue with people who just come in and post rude things or anything like that. We've got a pretty good bunch, I have to say. But Reddit seems to be an epicenter on the web for trolls and for a lot of unscrupulous things. There have even been these reports that we've heard about in the news of killers, rapists, and people like that allegedly going out there and bragging about these horrible acts that they have carried out and bragging about it because they can do so under the veil of anonymity on a forum like Reddit, which is a disturbing idea unto itself. And so Reddit has been the latest to go about intentionally banning certain people from speaking. Well, it wasn't Reddit on the whole, but it were the moderators, as it were, of the Reddit science category. Doubtful News, our friend Sharon Hill, reported on this, talking about the fact that comment moderation, according to some, is becoming a force for good. Good science, that is. Here's what they've said. The forum, known as R Science, provides a digital space for discussions about recent peer-reviewed scientific publications. Now, this puts us, along with R Ask Science, on the front lines of the science public interface, according to the spokespeople with the subreddit. On our little page, scientists and non-scientists alike can connect through discussions on everything from subatomic particles to interstellar astrophysics. Now, given that our users are mainly academics, and all are, well, basically nerds, the discussion generally resembles any scientific debate. That is, there are always numerous links to peer-reviewed science and support positions. People don't deliberately mislead or misrepresent content, and there's a basic level of respect shared regardless of position. But when a user strays from such decorum, they are kindly warned, and if necessary, the comment is removed. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because it is specifically people who are detracting from a particular argument that are being removed with consistency right now. The people with the subreddit for science have said that some issues, however, are particularly contentious. While evolution and vaccines do have their detractors, no topic consistently evokes such rude and such uninformed and such outspoken opinions as climate change. These people were true believers, blind to the fact that their arguments were hopelessly flawed. Notice they refer to them in the past tense here, and you'll find out why if you haven't figured it out already. The result of cherry-picked data and conspiratorial thinking. They had no idea that the smart-sounding talking points from their preferred climate blog were, even to a casual climate science observer, plainly wrong. They were completely enamored by the emotionally charged and rhetoric-based arguments of pundits on talk radio and Fox News. And so the end result was a disservice to science and to rational exploration, not to mention the scholarly audience that we are proud to have cultivated. When 97% of climate scientists agree that man is changing the climate, we would hope the comments would at least acknowledge, if not reflect, such widespread consensus. Since that was not the case, we needed more than just an ad hoc approach to correct this situation. The answer was found in the form of proactive moderation. About a year ago, we moderators became increasingly stringent with the deniers. When a potentially controversial submission was posted, a warning would be issued stating the rules for comments. Most importantly, that your comment can't be a conspiracy theory. And we advised that further violations of the rules could result in the commenter being banned from the forum. And so what they've decided is essentially that if a person wants to question a consensus opinion about climate science, that the moderators of the forum will effectively ban those users. Now, that's interesting, because I understand if someone is detracting from an argument and they're being rude, you know, and they're being the definition of what we call in internet speak a troll, I would completely understand the reason why a person might be removed. I can completely understand why there might be a necessity for severe moderation. But it's interesting that we are seeing scientific-oriented online presences like popular magazines, Popular Science being one, and the science subreddit taking an active role in silencing any opinion from people who bring an unconventional attitude to the discussion in calling it conspiracy theories. Now, I'm sure some of these are actually conspiracy theories. Some of these people are absolute wackos and nut jobs. I, for one, look at the science, and I do believe that certainly we are seeing climate change. I have questioned, and I don't think this is something that makes me a conspiracy theorist in regard to that subject, per se, I have questioned elements of the anthropogenic model for global warming. And I've questioned the anthropogenic model for global warming based on the fact that there are historical trends that have actually shown greater instances of high temperature during periods like the Maunder Minimum and as far back as the Middle Ages. And so it's interesting to me that I think that we should look at all the science, but certainly at least adhere to, I think, the consensus attitude among academics that, well, yes, in truth, there probably are some climate changes going on, and while we are in the process of understanding fully what is causing this, we're going to try and maintain a open but polite debate about it. Now, apparently, if you have questions about climate science and you have an opinion that is non-consensus on Reddit, you may be banned for having that and expressing that. And if you are a person who detracts from a consensus view on a scientific position, well, you're not going to have an opportunity to comment at all if you go to Popular Science, because they've disabled that feature out of fear that these attitudes would detract from the argument. It's interesting to me, though, because if you'd think that the scientific argument were strong enough, and I'm not saying that they aren't, but if an argument that is put forward by a scientific thinker, an institution, as a result of a research study, if this information comes forward and it is of merit and can stand on its own based on facts and principles espoused therein, then who cares if some troll wants to come along and question it or try and detract from it? Let those people be idiots, if they're idiots. Some of them may be right. But the point is that it seems, and I'll even admit this, it seems a bit odd to me that these mainstream publications and that areas within public forum like Reddit are actively suppressing those alternative viewpoints. That just seems strange to me. Now, I mentioned we were going to get into some ancient mystery talk here. And the reason I bring this up is because it seems that we are constantly having to revise, and this is part of science, and of course even the best of the mainstream scientists will tell you, yes, of course, there is room for and the permission for revising theories, revising even what are viewed as scientific facts or laws if there is evidence that can support and justify that. And perhaps in no area of science are we having to reconsider what we think we know more often, at least as of late, than in the realm of ancient anthropology, the study of ancient humans, and the study of where we, in likelihood, may come from. Now, while it has been known since around maybe 1908, after excavations that took place in caves in France, it's been known since, well, that's more than 100 years ago, that there is a possibility that Neanderthal men and women could have engaged in burial practices. But now, new research suggests that they indeed very well may have actually engaged in an act, the burial of their dead, that entails a symbolic or even maybe a ritual component. It was previously believed that Neanderthal man probably had not had the capacity of thought to be able to carry this sort of thing out, but we're having to change our opinions about these sorts of things. There was a similar story that came about recently that talked about the discovery, again in France, of a 400,000-year-old bone fragment. I believe it was from a thigh bone. Now, it was expected that when this thigh bone had been studied and when genetic tests were able to reveal the origin of the bone, it was expected it would probably have belonged to a Neanderthal. What's interesting is that it found, quite contrary, it was found to be from Denisovian descent. And for those who aren't up to speed on anthropology and what this would entail, we're talking about, first of all, a bone that genetically can be linked to an entirely separate group of individuals that occurred in an entirely separate location of the world. As a matter of fact, it was about 4,000 miles away in Siberia where this kind of Denisovian genetic information should have been expected or would have been expected to have been found. So here it turns up in France. And furthermore, this bone fragment is believed to be 400,000 years old, one of the oldest of its kind. And interestingly, the Denisovian genetic history, based on our current understanding of the lineage of ancient human ancestors, would have dated back to about 80,000 years ago. And so the new theory on the block about this particular find in France is that there was at one time a hybridization, a crossbreeding between the Denisovian and the Neanderthal people in ancient times, and that this specimen found in France was in likelihood, rather than being fully or actually Denisovian in origin, it was probably a hybrid, masquerading as it were. And it's a very, very interesting story because what this seems to point to is that not only are there probably branches and elements to ancient human history that we're having to reformulate and question, but researchers with the study had literally said that this may present cause for questioning whether, and in all likelihood, the reality that there may be ancient human ancestors, varieties of ancient hominids that existed that we absolutely have no knowledge of today. Now, what's also so interesting to me about this is the fact that when we take into consideration the existence of, let's just call them mystery hominids, mystery primates, for a person who is versed in Fortean phenomenon and the history and the study of the unexplained, naturally, I think something like Bigfoot would come to mind, wouldn't it? And I drew from my archives today this book. It's probably one of my favorite books on the subject. It's written by John Napier. It's called Bigfoot, very plain and simple, Bigfoot. The book was written in 1972, and in it, John Napier, he was an English-born primatologist who also served at the Smithsonian between, I think, 67 and 1969. He presents a very skeptical argument for Bigfoot. In fact, he determines that based on the evidence available to him in the early 70s, that there probably in likelihood was not what we know colloquially to be the abominable snowman. He didn't think that that creature could exist. But it's very interesting because I want to read this passage for you from this man of science at the end of this book. I'm sure he was criticized during his day, just like Jeffrey Meldrum is in the present day, Meldrum being, of course, the Idaho State University professor who is an advocate for the belief in existence of Bigfoot based on scientific data that he has collected and studied. But Napier wrote in 72, "I am convinced that Sasquatch exists. But whether it is all that it is cracked up to be is another matter altogether. There must be something in Northwest America that needs explaining, and that something leaves man-like footprints. Now, the evidence I have adduced in favor of the reality of the Sasquatch is not hard evidence. Few physicists, biologists, or chemists would accept it, but nevertheless, it is evidence, and it cannot be ignored." That was his ultimate conclusion. Now, I found that to be a very interesting statement. Think about this. physicists, chemists, biologists probably would not accept that as evidence. Why? Because when we're talking about evidence for the existence of a creature, like a Bigfoot, what we're talking about is essentially evidence that is circumstantial, based mostly on eyewitness testimonies. But there are some good ones. There are some very good ones. And yet, again, the consensus mainstream attitude toward the study of a creature like Bigfoot. Again, I like to try and say I'm agnostic. Like McNonymous and I talk about on Middle Theory, I'm in the middle about this. There was a time when I was younger that I absolutely believed that there was a Bigfoot. And now I've had to rein in on that belief because I have to allow myself to make my judgments based on what the facts entail. And I'll have to tell you this. While there are some compelling casts of footprints, for instance, the Bossberg tracks and a number of others that the late anthropologist Grover Krantz often spoke about that seem to indicate physical deformities and flaws that a hoaxer in likelihood would never have thought to promote or to try and forge for purposes of a really, really good hoax. There are some instances where certain footprints that have been recovered that are allegedly taken from a creature like a Bigfoot seem to indicate something physical, something real, something there. And then there's also the idea that certain witness testimonies are from incredibly reliable individuals. But none of this maybe really constitutes hard proof. We don't have a Bigfoot finger. We don't have Bigfoot hair. Despite what Melba Ketchum and others have said, in likelihood, folks, we probably don't have genetic material that can be used to sequence Sasquatch DNA. It's probably just not really what's going on. But the circumstantial evidence presented by people who have claimed to have their own encounters, some of them are really good. One of my favorite examples that I've talked about on the program in the past, in fact, dealt with an affidavit that had been signed by a man named William Rohu in 1955 around a mountain, if I remember correctly. Interestingly enough, it was called Micah Mountain in Washington State. William Rohu had described in great detail his observation of a female, well, a primitive human. He said it looked like a primitive female covered in hair. And there were native legends, of course, that went back even further than William Rohu's encounter. Albert Ostman claimed that he had been kidnapped by a family of Sasquatch creatures in the 1920s. His story didn't come out until the 1950s. But the reason it's important to look at certain reports from prior, especially to 1958, is because of an article that appeared in the news recently. The Pacific Standard carried this, and it was written by a gal, God love her heart, named Katie Heaney. And the article's titled, "Who Believes in Bigfoot? While the origins of the mythical beast are based around a hoax," she says, "today's believers are a very discriminating bunch." Now, some people would say, wait a minute, why, what do you mean Bigfoot is based around a hoax? Certain people in Fortean circles wouldn't necessarily think that the modern concept of Bigfoot is based around a hoax. In truth, however, this is both true and this is also absolutely horridly false. This is her reasoning. In the article, she says, "In 1958, outside a logging camp near Bluff Creek, California, an employee of a Humboldt County construction company spotted a set of oversized footprints much too large to be human and too human-like to be ape. The Humboldt Times picked up the story, and the reporter, Andrew Ginzoli, noted that the spotter and his construction crew, who had taken plaster casts of the prints, had given the mystery creature responsible for them a nickname. They called him Bigfoot. And hence the legend was born." Just like Kenneth Arnold reporting the erratic flight behavior of objects he saw over Mount Rainier, right there in the same region, interestingly enough. And as he talked to the press, he referred to their flight as like a saucer skipping across the water. Well, the press ran with it. Flying saucers are born, in name alone. And perhaps, yes, in 1958, as a result of what was later revealed to be a hoax perpetrated by a man named Ray Wallace, where he strapped large footprints to his, or castings of human-like feet that were very large to his boots, and he ran around on this logging site and left these huge footprints. Sure, Ray Wallace may have hoaxed the entire thing, and the media created a name for it based on what these people were calling these things. Here comes old Bigfoot. That was in 1958. And this whole article is based on the fact that, as the subtitle reads, while the origins of the mythical beast, are based around a hoax. Now, Heaney concludes this article by saying, "The circumstances of the legend's origin don't matter so much. It's still here, converting people. Bigfoot lives." But you know what's very interesting is, well, if that information were accurate, she's right about the name, but the reports of the creature itself go back much, much earlier. By the 1940s, there was an American agent living alongside the Chehalis named J.W. Burns, who'd been collecting stories about these strange beings, these wild people that the Chehalis natives in Washington State, especially around Harrison Lake and in British Columbia and whatnot, had talked about. And these people believed that these were actually beings who were somehow related to them. And yet, again, here we see a person, and, you know, I'm not just trying to pick her apart and make her look bad. I guess Katie Heaney, based on her cursory knowledge of the alleged existence of a creature like Bigfoot, was writing what she thought to be a historically accurate narrative, whereas, in truth, she was dead wrong. She was right about part of it, but she's absolutely wrong about the origin of Bigfoot being based on a hoax. The origin of the name, yes, but the native traditions, as well as the accounts of the likes of William Rowe. There was a famous incident that was referred to as the Ruby Creek incident that involved a family that claimed that a large, hairy, wild man had come down and basically raided a barrel with salted fish on their property. There are a lot of these kinds of stories that have come forward over the years, and they do seem to point to something. And even John Napier, a well-respected British primatologist who had worked with the Smithsonian Institute, even John Napier and many other people in academia have been convinced. Jeffrey Meldrum is another example. Jane Goodall has, in many instances, talked about her romantic hope that there is indeed a creature like a Bigfoot that might exist. I see in the chat room, by the way, that Justin's linked to an article with a drawing of what William Rowe saw. His daughter had created a rendering, and indeed it is a very, very detailed account and a very interesting story. And that took place in 1955. That wasn't based on an ancient Indian legend. That wasn't based on myth and hearsay. This was a man who had been out. He was armed with a hunting rifle, and he observed this creature through a scope and said that he felt that if he had killed this thing to prove its existence, he would have been possibly committing murder. It's very interesting to me. To bring this back to the discussion from earlier about ancient humans and the statements from anthropologists who have said there may have been hominids that existed before modern humans that we have no knowledge about. And furthermore, when we talk about the potential for there being hybridization between Denisovians, Neanderthal, various different groups, when you look down at Heidelberg man and the period of gigantism that they went through hundreds of thousands of years ago, and that the fossil record indicates that they went through a period where it was the norm for these primates, these hominids, to be about 7 to 9 feet tall at the most. There's nothing in the fossil record based on our ancestry and other hominid species that have come and gone throughout our ancient history. Nothing that says that a creature like a Bigfoot couldn't exist. The problems inherent with their existence are based on their geographic location. Let's look at the Pacific Northwest, where Bigfoot is most widely believed to still exist. One of the staunchest arguments, and one that even John Napier brought to the table, despite coming to the ultimate conclusion that he thought there was something behind the story and that there had to be something going on, whether or not it was all that it was cracked up to be, as he said. The idea that there was a Bigfoot only didn't work for him when it came to the discussion about what these things would be eating in an area like the Pacific Northwest. Now, frankly, I like to quote the character from Jurassic Park, Dr. Ian Malcolm, "Life finds a way." You remember that? I like to quote Dr. Ian Malcolm. I'm of a mind to think that, yeah, life does find a way. There are animals all around the world As a matter of fact, in the most extreme instances, there is a name for these kinds of animals, extremophiles. Different varieties of life that can exist in extreme areas on planet Earth, like, you know, around lava vents, deep down within the ocean or deep underground. You know, think about blind cave salamanders that literally come to exist. They evolve to exist with the absence of what humans know to be their dominant sense. Life and its adaptability is a very strange thing, but it's still hard for a lot of people of science to buy the idea that a creature so large as a Bigfoot could potentially exist and still manage to feed itself. Come back to this story that we were talking about. We opened the discussion here with live science reporting on Neanderthal basically having the ability to potentially bury their dead and recognize this for the symbolism it may have entailed. I mean, I, for one, would think maybe there were other reasons why they might learn. You know, for instance, if there's a rotting corpse lying around in a cave that you exist in and it's littering the cave and it's creating probably an unfriendly odor, it might do well to bury a body for sanitary reasons. They might not have looked at it as something that would prevent disease, but an ancient hominid might have looked at burying a corpse as being something that prevented that horrible odor that seemed to be emitting from the thing that flies were buzzing all around, right? You know, there may have been a more practical excuse that led to the eventual ritual act of burial. But if Neanderthal could do it, if the Neanderthal could bury their dead, and if there's some evidence that shows this, if we look back, and yet again, I think Live Science carried this story, was it yesterday? Headline reads, human hand fossil turns back the clock 500,000 years. We were talking about a 400,000-year-old thigh bone in France that has changed the playing field in terms of what we expect of the human ancient family tree. Go back 500,000 years. The discovery of a 1.4 million-year-old hand bone fossil, I apologize, even earlier than I was discussing there, reveals that human ability among modern humans to make and use complex tools may have originated far earlier. A critical trait that distinguishes modern humans from all other species alive today is the ability to make complex tools. It's not just the extraordinarily powerful human brain that allows us, but also the human hand that gives humans the unique ability. In contrast, apes, humans' closest living relatives, lack a powerful and precise enough grip to create and use complex tools effectively. But interesting among these reports that we're talking about is the idea that around, let's see, gosh, how far are we going back? I guess 1.5 million years ago, researchers have discovered a fossil about 1.5 million years old that possesses this vital anatomical feature, meaning it existed more than 500,000 years earlier than it was previously known to have existed among hominids. Now, that doesn't blow your mind. So think about this. Ancient human ancestors may have been capable of a lot more than what we expect. And furthermore, certain varieties might have existed right alongside one another on planet Earth, maybe even capable of interbreeding with one another. To me, while we may not have hard proof that without question confirms the existence of a creature like a Bigfoot, to me right now, I don't think that the present level of scientific knowledge about that is complete, and I certainly don't think that the existence of a creature like a Bigfoot is anything that we could particularly rule out for the time being. It's very interesting. There may be more to ancient human history than we know, and of course that ever mysterious family tree of ours. When we come back, Soraya Eiskath will be joining us here on the Grailian Report, talking about the magic and the occult side of things. We'll be back right after this.
We'll be right back. is the Grailian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And hey, welcome back. Glad to be here with you, Micah Hanks. The mouth of the South here. We're about to dive into a conversation with Soraya Ascath of Where Did the Road Go? But before we do, I have a few brief announcements that we'd like to be making here. By the way, hi to Wish and goodbye to Zadok in the chat room there. Glad to see a few people sticking around. Tomorrow, which for those of you getting the podcast anytime between Tuesday night and Monday morning, or Wednesday morning, wow, traveling back in time here. We are going to be broadcasting the Middle Theory program for this week tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And then sometime after the first of the year, we will probably be switching to a new time. We'll keep you posted about that for all you members of the secret society known as the world's most secret society out there. Glad to see a lot of you up there in the chat room tonight. But we'll be doing that live broadcast tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, so I hope to see you all there. And, of course, we will also be doing... I'm looking, and I'm going to be putting this up on the website, so keep your eyes peeled. I'm looking at doing a special year-end bash for the Grailian Report. I mean, I want to do something really special. And so if you've got ideas that you'd like to send along about what you might like to hear for a year-end roundup, I'm talking about getting some of the very best guests. We're talking about getting some of the very best subjects and some of the most enlightening entertainment, maybe even holiday-themed material to incorporate into this. We'll have time and details in there as well, but maybe some of the folks here in the live chat, they can toss along some information to me about what you would like to hear. Because I'm very sad, and I should make the official announcement here. Ben and Aaron from Mysterious Universe contacted me, and they said that because of the technical difficulties involved with trying to do a simulcast, we did a live simulcast last year, and apparently the guys don't want to try and have to overcome the technical hurdles. I guess not everybody is as technically proficient as the mouth of the South. I think the only thing that's really, truly technically proficient about me is the way and the speed at which my mouth runs, But all the more to them because Ben and Aaron have a fantastic program, and I'd like them to do a good job with or without the mouth of the South. But that said, I think I'm going to have to do something to kick off the new year in style. And heck, maybe we could even get Ben and Aaron to call in. You know, if we don't do a simulcast, maybe they'd be involved in some other way. I'm sure they would. They're great guys and dear friends of the program. And so let's look into that. And if you have information that you'd like to send along about your ideas or what you might like to hear, info@grailianreport.com will get you lined up direct to the bunker with me. Now, that said, moving right along, our guest this hour is a controversial gentleman. He is the host of a radio program and a weekly podcast. He's also a person who is well-versed in such things as the occult and magic. And I knew when I booked him to come on this program that he might be one of the most controversial people I've ever interviewed on this show. I don't know how this is going to go, folks. I don't know how people are going to react to it. I certainly don't know where the road is going to go. But he is the host of the very program of the same name. Soraya Ascath joins us here on the Grailian Report for the first time. Soraya, welcome, and how are you?
All right. I think you're talking me up a little too much as overly controversial, though.
Oh, you no, sir. You're the most controversial man I've ever known. Well, good to have you here on with us. I want to start right off the bat with your name. And we had, you know, you have some foreknowledge of this. I know that you had mentioned that we would want to talk about that. Let's start with your name, because it's a very unusual name. Soraya Ascath. Am I pronouncing it entirely correctly?
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much. Close enough, huh?
Close enough. The name came after a very bizarre experience, but I think I need to go back a little further and get in what led up to it to really make any sense out of it, if that's all right.
Well, let's do it. Take us all the way back.
All right. So I was always interested in the paranormal and the unexplained and stuff like that. And growing up, I always read books on Atlantis and UFOs. But it was just one of many things I was interested in. I had absolutely no interest in magic or the occult or anything like that. And this kind of ties in when the last time you were on my show, we talked about how Fate magazine saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, growing up, I started experiencing something I simply couldn't explain. It initially started with very strange hallucinations and ended up with pain in different areas of my body that no doctor could diagnose, and other just very bizarre things happening. And it wasn't until I picked up an issue of Fate magazine that just mysteriously showed up at my door one day. I had never heard of it, read it cover to cover, loved it, subscribed to it. A few issues later, they had a book on from Llewellyn on Kundalini. Most people have never heard of this. They might have heard of Kundalini yoga. I had never heard of it. But after almost a decade of really horrible problems that were non-diagnosable, I suddenly found out that this is what I was experiencing. And this took me into everything. Now, are you at all familiar with this?
Somewhat, I am, indeed. But now for the listeners who aren't, let's go ahead and dive into it a little.
Well, Kundalini, especially nowadays, is a style of yoga, and it wakes up energy that, and the actual term means a coiled serpent.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that the energy starts at the bottom of your spine and goes straight up your spine to the top of your head, and it's a very spiritual awakening type of an experience. Some people, however, it wakes up on them without any effort. It just wakes up. And when it does that, it can damn near kill you.
In what way? And how would it damn near kill you? I mean, it sounds dangerous.
Well, in some people, it makes them extraordinarily sick. There's a great book by John White, and it's a compilation of different authors, and it's not New Age at all. It goes back to ancient Indian texts and different Hindu writings and stuff talking about what this can do. And in my case, it caused me extraordinary pain. Like, I've never felt pain like that in my life. To this day, I've never felt anything that painful. It feels like someone's stabbing you in the knife, or stabbing you with a burning knife in the spine and just twisting. And when you don't know what it is, and the doctor's telling you there's nothing wrong with you, you're kind of lost. So that issue of Fate magazine showing up, you know, led me in the right direction. I may never have found out about it if it wasn't for Fate.
A bit of synchronicity there, huh?
Yeah, kind of. So what it does is, as it rises, it hits different blocks in your system. And those blocks are things you're not dealing with, and it just burns until you deal with them. If you don't know that's what's going on, you have no way of dealing with it. It's not voluntary in that case. If you're using Kundalini yoga, it's something entirely different, because you're raising it properly, you're doing it in a balanced way. But as a 15-year-old kid, I had no idea what was happening to me.
So you see, these essences literally were just autonomously coming about, is what you're saying?
Yes, very much so. There were times I literally blacked out from the pain. Once I learned what it was, once I did some research, I was able to start doing things to kind of balance it out better and get it to work through these blocks and actually work with it rather than just, fighting it as you would any kind of pain. This is also, are you familiar at all with the laughing churches?
No, I'm not.
There is a phenomena out there that certain Christian churches, they one person will start laughing, and they get the Holy Spirit filling them. Mm. And as they touch other people, the laughing spreads to them. That's Kundalini.
Interesting. Now, I have heard of that, actually, now that you mention it. Now that you've described what it is. Yeah, I've heard of this. Almost similar in a way to talking in tongues.
Yes, yeah, similar. But the Kundalini energy, whatever, it does a lot of very strange things to you. It can cause various hallucinations. Before the pain, when I just had the mild hallucinations, that was the first thing that tipped me off when I was reading the information on Kundalini, and I was like, this is fascinating. This is exactly what I experienced. They're audio hallucinations, visual hallucinations. You know they're hallucinations because they're things that couldn't possibly be happening to you.
Well, give me an example. I mean, if you can.
Well, I would play trombone when I was a kid, mm-hmm. and I would see smoke coming out of the end of it. Hmm. Now, there's no smoke coming out of it. It's not even something that could possibly happen, but there it was. And, as a 14-year-old kid, that was really scary.
To say the least.
So as I worked with this more and more, it also has a lot of electromagnetic effects. It can make you and this is something that is in common with UFO abductees, with near-death experiences. You've been talking about this with watches.
I was just about to ask. Yeah, have you had the watch phenomenon happen?
Oh, yeah, the watch phenomena and all kinds of electronics. Huh. And I've given people some really hellacious shocks before, too, when it's been really raised up. I also sometimes pulsate from it, especially when I sleep, apparently.
You know, I'm waiting for you to tell me that you glow in the dark, too, Soraya.
not that I'm aware of. But anyway, the name, if we get to that... one day it started up, it started with pain, and then the pain went away. And it actually shot all the way through my system. And at first it felt fantastic because it was, I think, the first time the Kundalini had actually cleared a bunch of blocks out. The next thing I experienced was the most horrible sense of loss and desolation I've ever felt in my life.
Ah.
And what had happened, I realized later, is it you know, as we go, we build up these structures, these assumptions, and we kind of like climb on top of them, and we build more assumptions up, and then we look at the world from that perspective, and that's our view. And when this thing blocked out, when it came through and knocked all these blocks out, it knocked all those assumptions down, and it just left me feeling so empty and lost. And like, you know, when you have that really bad feeling about something and multiply it by 1,000.
Oh, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, I thought I was dying and I had no idea why or what was happening to me. And afterwards, I suddenly got these streaks of inspiration. All this stuff that never made a sense to me before was suddenly crystal clear. And I started writing it all down and I was just amazed. And it took me a little while to put this all together. A couple days later, we had gone to see the Scorpions.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we're driving home. Friend of mine's driving. His wife's asleep in front of me. My friend's asleep to the left of me in the back seat. And the name Soraya is spoken directly through my head. Very loudly, very clearly, in a voice I've come to be very familiar with. And I knew at the time it was my name, even though that made absolutely no sense to me.
Hmm.
You know, my first response was, okay, one of them must have said it. Well, both girls were completely asleep. There was no other sounds in the car. The thing was extraordinarily loud. And I resisted it for quite a long time. I didn't want to use it. It seemed like a ridiculous thing to do. So that's where the name comes from.
Now, you say that you had an actual voice present this name to you. You were presented with this. Now, you, I presume this maybe would be something that one might liken to being like a spirit guide or something like that, I guess?
Yeah, that's probably the best way of putting it. I don't consider it that, but that's probably the most common understanding.
Well, what would you consider it to be, Soraya?
I don't. That's the thing. I don't consider it to be anything that I can conceive of exactly. Hmm. It's something I've interacted with all my life, but I don't want to put a label on it.
Fair enough. Fair enough. But this is nonetheless something that has been kind of a guiding force for you, I take it.
Very much so. And it's given me very exact information about upcoming things. It has warned me about stuff. And it's a voice that's so perfect that it always makes me think of Carl Jung's, is it an anima or an animus if it's female?
I believe it's the anima.
I think it is the anima. It always makes me think of that because it's always that perfect image of your female counterpart.
So the voice that you hear is female?
Yes.
Hmm. It's funny that you brought up Carl Jung because I, too, was thinking of that. Carl Jung, you probably remember this. He had talked about when he got about to be in his 30s. He said that he'd had all these experiences where he began to have these, he called it a violent confrontation with his subconscious, but he too would hear voices and he would have things happen. Now, there's some people who would tell you straight up, if you have this kind of experience, you're out of your mind, you're having a psychopathic break from reality. I don't think that that is always the case by any means. In fact, I mean, I've even studied native cultures that make very clear distinctions between a seer or a shaman who is capable of rendering experiences where these voices are heard and they are able to receive information from other realms, so to speak. They make a clear distinction between these individuals and then people who they would call crazy or insane, people who have an issue. You know, you don't seem like a crazy person to me, Soraya.
And I always doubt everything I experience. For better or worse, I don't necessarily believe anything that happens to me right off the bat. I take it apart. I analyze it. I look for any logical conclusion. Of course, that's always one of them. Am I just losing my mind? I thought for a decade I was losing my mind when it was just Kundalini.
Interesting. Well, you know, I'm glad to be able to tell you right now that you're not losing your mind. And listen, we've got to run to a break, but stick with us because when we come back, I want to get into talking with you a little bit about how these experiences have shaped, well, that road that you've headed down. I'm also interested in knowing where the name, Where Did the Road Go, come from. We'll talk about all that and more when we come back here on the Grayling Report. Our guest is Soraya Ozcoth. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South, and it is the Grayling Report. We'll be back right after this. On her Agra... Boy, just leave it to me to just destroy it, trying to come back. I was going to attempt to say Archetypal Majesty's Secret Service. Then again, though, I don't know if there's such a thing as a secret service in that line of work. Welcome back to the program. It is the Grayling Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, and we're talking with an interesting guy by the name of Soraya Ozcoth right now. Now, he's the host of a podcast and a radio program, and I want to ask him a little bit about that in this next segment. The program, I've been a guest on it numerous times. It's called Where Did the Road Go? And my question to you, Soraya Ozcoth, in relation to your work, where did the road go? What is the meaning of that name? Because obviously, if I'm to take this to mean that there is symbolism behind it, it has something to do with the profundity that you've experienced in your lifetime. What's going on with that name there?
You would think that. It actually doesn't.
Well, I'm wrong.
It came from an event. We were working with a wrestling company doing some promotion, and we were up in Watertown, and we came out of this event and we just wanted to go get something to eat. We didn't know our way around Watertown. It's way up top of New York State. And we kind of looked around and said, hey, the lights are sort of in that direction. Let's go that way. So we started to drive down the road and the road kind of dipped down and suddenly I was on gravel and then lawn. And what came out of my mouth is, where did the road go?
Goodness.
And I've been doing a music show for about 20 years. And when we told someone this story, she said, that should be the name of the memoirs for the music show. And that wasn't something that was going to happen. But when I started doing this, I thought, you know, that's a perfect name for a show about fringe topics, about the paranormal and lost civilizations and stuff like that. Because it's kind of like going where people haven't gone before, where there aren't roads.
Yeah, it's funny because it reminds me a bit of that that famous phrase from Back to the Future, where we're going, Marty, we don't need roads.
Exactly.
And to an extent, maybe you don't in this biz. But now, I'll ask you this, too. I've always been fascinated with magic and the occult. I've never been a practitioner, but you know, you have elucidated to me in some of our conversations, Soraya, that maybe you have been a little more involved in that sort of thing. While I've studied the history of it, Aleister Crowley is a fascinating historical character to me. What is your involvement in magic and the occult?
Well, once I started to, you know, open up to some of this stuff, and initially I was very closed off to anything like that. Someone had introduced me into Wicca. And I found it kind of interesting, loved the idea of something that went back, you know, centuries into ancient times and stuff. And when I started doing some real research, I found out, well, it really didn't. And although there are different types of folk magic, modern Wicca is only a few decades old. You know, it started around the late 40s, early 50s with Gardner and stuff. And that goes back to Aleister Crowley. Crowley's work was the inspiration for a lot of the stuff that ended up in Wicca.
Right.
So I started looking into Crowley, and I liked the fact that Crowley kind of took a more or less scientific approach to magic. He wanted to know why it worked. He didn't want to know, you know, he wasn't worried about the belief systems or anything else. He wanted to kind of cut it down to its basics and understand the mechanisms that caused it to work. And so I started following that a little bit and other, you know, just reading anything I could get my hands on. And I became more or less what's considered to be a chaos magician.
Oh, great.
Because, well, I kind of go with whatever works for me. I don't worry about following anything to the letter. I go with what feels correct to me, hence the chaos part. I didn't know there was a term for it. That's how I did things. And eventually I picked up books like there's one called Psychonaut that's very good on the subject. Mm. And, you know, it's called chaos magic. So I would just, you know, the symbolism that works for me, I don't, you know, it's not you have to learn what every little thing means. It's more by feel. And it's not black magic or necessarily even white magic. I mean, it depends what you're doing with it. And for me, it's always been something to clarify things in life and to kind of awaken different ideas.
Interesting. I would like to ask your approach to, I mean, or do you have a feeling toward the jurisdictions of black magic and white magic? Is there such a thing as black or white magic? Do they have the kind of effect that folklore and mythology seem to append to those things? And if so, do you know people who are actually active practitioners of these magical arts?
Well, it all depends on your definition. Crowley considered black magic anything that did not lead you toward knowledge of your true self.
Hmm. Okay.
Which I think is a very good definition. So when you're practicing magic, you do stuff to add to that enlightenment. If you're not doing that, then you're practicing black magic. Now, some people would say anyone who practices black magic is trying to harm others. And that's a reasonable definition as well. I'm not really familiar with people who practice magic other than myself, to be totally honest. I know some of the stuff I've done has worked very, very well. And I can tell you one of the creepiest experiences I ever had.
Yeah, let's hear it.
And this involves doing a piece of ceremonial magic that was just, I don't even remember what I was doing. It was probably just for, you know, furthering clarification on the future or something to that effect. And I have a big spot of land. And out back, a lot of creepy things have happened, but I have a gigantic barn, and behind this barn, it is absolutely pitch black. So, middle of the night, I'm out there doing this ritual, and the last thing I do is I knock this staff on the ground 3 times. Well, as I do this, you can't hear it knocking on the ground because it's grass, and I tap it 3 times on the ground, and from the barn over to the side, in the exact same pattern, I get bang, bang, bang.
Really?
First of all, it's a creepy barn. It kind of looks like the Amityville house. Has that sort of face in the front. So for all places, for that to have knocked from there, chills just went up my spine. And I went, oh, that's good.
I can only imagine.
And I had to walk past it to get back to the house.
Have you ever had continuing instances of strange things that have seemed to emanate from that area of your property?
From the area I was actually in, yes, not the barn. That's the only thing that ever happened to the barn. But that back area has something very odd with it, and I don't know if it's an earth energy type of thing or what.
You're in, let's see, are you near Rochester, New York? Is that correct?
About an hour and a half from Rochester.
Okay, I got you. Because, you know, I was just going to say that down south where I am, you know, people, when they go out behind the barn to do things, it's usually a little different from what you're describing. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
That's true.
Yeah, it's a little different culture down here where I am in Appalachia. But anyhow, well, you know, I mean, now you've utilized these magical processes. Where, again, you know, have you drawn your knowledge of magical arts? I mean, reading in books, have you been taught by someone? Have you been instructed otherwise? I mean, I'm interested in this because it seems to me what you're describing to be a continuation of ritual practices that people have carried out for centuries. The question is, where does it all come from? A quick example, you know, last week on this program, and I got a lot of email from people I hadn't had time to get to on the program tonight, but it has to do with this discussion about the Holy Grail that I brought up. And one of my listeners had even pointed out that despite the fact that there's not really a direct reference to it in Eastern culture, the tea drinking ceremony seems to be very similar to the idea of the Grail. The Grail, for me, though, is necessarily the cup that, you know, Christ had at the Last Supper, the cup that, you know, Arthur, you know, bound his kingdom together with, you know, and drew its power from. To me, the search for that Grail is something representative of a deeper symbolic something that is within each of us. And it seems that magic and ritual is the pursuit of that deeper, whatever that is, that any of us could access, but it seems to be something from within. So what led you to this path, and how did you learn? Where do you draw your actual knowledge of the magical ritual, for instance? Where does that come from?
Well, initially it came from people like Aleister Crowley and other stuff I would read. I read a lot of Kenneth Grant stuff. Grant gets a little bit weird when he gets into like connecting everything into Lovecraft, but it always fascinated me. But I also picked up I pick up stuff from dreams. I will have, you know, very profound lucid dreams where I'm taught how to do things, and then I do them and they work.
That's interesting. You know, speaking of H.P. Lovecraft also talked about dreams. You know, I know you to be a person who's very interested in Lovecraft, and we've talked about that, yes, a bit in the past. So when it comes to H.P. Lovecraft, I mean, do you think that he was in touch with something similar maybe to some of your own experiences, i.e. that there was something actually dictating some of this to him? People have talked about that.
Well, I wonder if unconsciously he was connected to something, if he was picking up something, you know, deeper down inside of himself that he just never fully acknowledged.
I've even heard and this is really speculative, but there have been people who have, as a matter of fact, I don't really put anything into this, but I'll state it just for the sake of interest. There have been people who have said that they thought that Lovecraft had possibly been an alien abductee because some of the things that he described were so similar to modern alleged encounters with alien beings. Now, what's interesting is digging into Carl Jung's writing, he talked about some of his patients having similar experiences. When it comes to the discussion of bedtime encounters, sleep paralysis, and things like that, have you had those experiences as well, Soraya?
Not so much the sleep paralysis or anything like that. I have had a few UFO encounters.
Really?
None of them have amounted to any kind of abduction or interaction. Some of them have been, like I had one about a month ago, actually. That was very strange. I saw a massive UFO about 13 years ago now, beginning of 2000, and but those events didn't have any profound effect on me. I mean, they were fascinating, but they weren't as deep as some of these other things that I've encountered. When I started practicing magic and actually getting results and actually communicating with things, one of the things, I had also started reading Whitley Strieber's Communion and Transformation. Mm-hmm. And at some point I realized what he's describing is the same stuff I'm experiencing, but without the alien mask to it.
How interesting.
Huh. And I didn't know anyone else made that connection. As far as I know, no one has made that connection as far as the occult goes. But then I read Jacques Vallée's Dimensions and saw that he took that mask off too and connected it to the fairy faith and angels, demons, and so on. And I went, okay, so it's not my imagination. This very well could be the same phenomena, but without the alien face to it.
I often, Soraya, think that the interpretation of alien abduction as being something that is, A, and we've talked about this again, but, you know, for the benefit of the listeners, you've also probably heard me talk about this. For the record, I want to make this you know, I want to tie this all together. The idea that alien encounters, as we refer to them, are necessarily something that is inextricably linked to UFOs is not an idea I'm a proponent of. Now, a lot of people would think, oh, this is hogwash, all this alien stuff and all this junk about UFOs. Clearly, we have to acknowledge that there are technologically controlled objects that are seen in the sky that in various instances cannot be explained. I wonder if they are truly extraterrestrial. By the same token, I wonder if these experiences, after finding the parallels in magical literature, after finding the parallels in the writings of Carl Jung, and seeing the similarities between these things and what popular writers on the abduction subject, including Bud Hopkins and Whitley Strieber, seeing all these parallels, I think even someone like Strieber, with the depth of knowledge that he has, he probably would recognize those parallels, and he would probably agree that there seems to be something more going on here than a physical interaction with an alien entity or with an alien presence. I mean, do you think that this is, for instance, when you have experiences that you would liken to things that Strieber had gone through in his lifetime and wrote about in his books, do you feel that it is truly a physical phenomenon that's occurring, or is there something that transcends the physical and something that is maybe something apart from the physical but nonetheless real?
Oh, I definitely think it's apart from the physical but definitely real. I think it interacts with you on such a subjective level, however, that you can't separate it from that. It may have a physical effect that may exist outside of you, but part of it only exists because it's interacting with you.
I see. I have to ask you about this. There's a researcher named Daniel Boudillion who has talked about this, and I've seen others bring it up too, and it's become more and more popular in books dealing with ufology because I think more and more UFO writers are running out of material to rip off. The question I wanted to ask you about is the apparent presence that Crowley often referenced. Lam. Some say lamb, but, and I may have talked with you about this, I think it's lam because he said that it was taken from the same prefix of the Tibetan word, the way or the path, lama. And so I think he would have probably said lam rather than lamb. But that little entity, if you've seen the image, he looks a little like an alien gray. Do you think there's a connection between the two, like some ufologists have asserted?
I've heard that. That actually started with Kenneth Grant. And Crowley himself said that lam was a self-portrait.
A self-portrait?
Yes, it was in an ideal state. Now, it may have, you know, been from connection with something else, or it could have just been the way Crowley thought of himself.
That's an interesting.
But Kenneth Grant, as far as I know, was the first one to suggest that it may have a connection to alien grays.
Now, Kenneth Grant was the director who had done the film Lucifer Rising, and
I know who you're talking about. Name is escaping me right now. Kenneth Grant was an occult writer. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you look online for any of his books, you're lucky if you can find any of them for under $100.
Really?
Yeah. And he, like I said, he gets way out there. He starts connecting everything into Lovecraft and different, making connections between different magical systems, even, you know, magical systems that aren't like Lovecraft stuff. Because Lovecraft didn't create a magical system, but he set up an entire dark side of the Tree of Life populated by Lovecraftian entities.
He certainly created a mythos, if nothing else.
Lovecraft, yes, absolutely. But he didn't create a belief system. He never tried to sell it as a belief system. I often wonder if Lovecraft's stuff, if we get, you know, 200, 300 years from now, will Lovecraft's stuff become a religion because people will forget it was a fiction?
I think sometimes that the ancient epics that we read and the ancient religious texts that we maintain today, and I'm sure that's the exact parallel that you're making, probably in a lot of instances what we read would be the Lovecraft writings of that day. And yet we look at it and this becomes the very essence for ancient aliens.
Yeah, well, that's very possible. Someone in the chat had just asked about results from doing different magical things. It kind of depends what I was trying to do. Usually I was looking for information, and if I got that information, well, then what I was doing was successful, and I would count that as a result. I've also had a habit of asking the universe for things. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't, but it feels like it's the same type of connection. The problem is sometimes you got to be very careful about what you ask for. Mm-hmm. For example, there was a few years back I had asked, I basically just asked the universe, I need about $2,000. It would really help me catch up on some bills and take care of stuff. A couple days later, I hit a deer. Well, the deer made every effort to get in front of me, stuck its head out, took out my headlight, knocked me off the road down a ravine. Going down this ravine, I was doing about 60 miles an hour. I was sure I was dead. And I just looked at this row of trees coming up, and I said, well, that's it. And I went through the row of trees without a scratch. Then there was a bigger row of trees. And I said, okay, well, this is it. Car stopped like it landed on a pillow. I get out. I ended up in a swamp. When I looked at where the car hit among the trees, now I had no control over the car. The car hit the only spot in the trees where there were no trees. It was the exact spacing of the car. There was a car butted up on the right side, or a tree butted up on the right side and left side of the car. And I was fine. Tow truck almost couldn't get it out of the ravine. Turned out it had about $30 worth of damage on it. But the insurance company decided to total it, which I initially argued until the guy said, well, look, we're just going to give you $2,000 and you can keep the car.
That's a win-win, isn't it?
But, you know, I looked at it and said, so thanks for the $2,000, universe, but next time let's not throw me into a ravine.
I'd rather not have whiplash along with the cash.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I was fine, but it was, you know, not the way I would have wanted to get it.
Yeah, well, I've heard this old expression, and I'm sure you're familiar with it as well. If you'd like to make God laugh, tell him your plans for the future.
True.
Yeah,
true.
He may smash you into a tree as well.
I've had a lot of things like that happen where I've just flat out asked for something. I know how to make that connection, and it's the same type of connection when you do a magical ritual. It's almost like a state of mind. When you hear people talk of the law of attraction, are you familiar with that?
Absolutely, yeah.
A lot of that actually comes from the Seth material and Jane Roberts, but it connects in with magic as well. And if consciousness forms reality rather than the other way around, it makes a lot of sense. And what a magical ritual is doing is it's affecting your unconscious mind. Crowley always warned of a lust for result. And he would say, if you do a magical ritual and then you just kind of sit there waiting for something to happen, it's never going to happen. You do a ritual and then you put it out of mind and you forget it. And that's when you'll get an effect from it. Seth basically said the same thing in Jane Roberts' work, saying that, you know, you affect reality in your unconscious mind, not your conscious mind. So if it's in your conscious mind, it's not going to that level that affects reality. And you know, that is kind of the premise upon which magic works, is that you're affecting reality on a very deep level, and that you're altering your unconscious with symbols and, you know, doing things to kind of shock your system or put it in a certain state. And then you got to leave it behind and get out of that state so it can actually have an effect.
You know, it's well worded the way that you articulate that, by the way. That's very interesting. What would you – okay, I have to ask. Maybe this is kind of dovetailing onto the end of that last statement, but what would you – if someone were to come to you and say, I would like, Soraya, for you to give me advice about how I might be able to improve my life. And obviously the implication here is that this person proposes that they want to improve their life via magic. Some people, even in this listening audience, would probably – say that that's not something you should do. It's bad. It's evil. Is it something that someone can do? Do you think a person can utilize magic to improve their life, or are there truly dangers that need to be adhered to? Is this something that people, if they don't know what they're doing, shouldn't be messing with?
That's a hard question. I've had some very experiences that I would say initially were bad, but when I look back on them, I realize that they weren't bad at all. They seemed bad at the time, but they actually propelled me forward quite a bit. And that's like with anything in life. We look at bad experiences when we're going through them and we think, oh, this is awful. But when we get to the other side, we might say, oh, well, I'm glad that happened, even though it sucked while it was happening. I think magic, kind of like meditation and such like that, can always help you with your life if you pursue it with a genuine interest. If you're not, you know, if you're going in it to try and hurt someone, what was it that Crowley said? Crowley said, it doesn't matter why someone gets involved in the practice of magic, because by the time they are effective, by the time that person who wants to kill someone actually has the power to kill someone, they're going to know better than to do it.
I wish we could say the same for all the idiots out there who claim people's lives. Maybe in that context, magic is something that could be viewed, however you choose to view it, as something that really at its heart, if done properly, involves self-improvement. And a person who improves and who seeks, furthermore, to improve upon themselves would never misuse a power like that. There's a kind of a sublime element to it, I suppose. Soraya, my last question for you, before I give you some time to talk about what you're doing, where people can find you online. Aleister Crowley, does he have a bad rap? Was he really the most wicked man that ever existed, or did he just get a bad rap?
Oh, he clearly got a bad rap, but he also encouraged it. He had a fantastic sense of humor, and the fact that he viewed the people around him as too ignorant to understand what he was doing, he just played off of it and had fun with it. It seems like near the end of his life he might have regretted it a little bit, but he wasn't a bad guy by any stretch of the imagination. He was actually a very, very, very smart. He was very brilliant. He was a master mountain climber. He did just some astounding things in his life, and it's... anyone who's interested in him really needs to read his autobiography, because it's eye-opening. He is so far ahead of his time, which is why he was so bedeviled back then. He was openly bisexual at the turn of the century, when that was totally unacceptable, and I believe even illegal in England, where he was. He was just a very unique individual.
He certainly was. I believe that book is the auto hagiography is what he calls it, which I was interested with that title and wanted to know exactly what it meant. And an auto hagiography would actually be an autobiography that a saint pens about themselves. And so it's funny that he utilized that term, obviously, both, I think, in reverence to himself and perhaps also as a final little wink for those who would come along and stumble onto that book. Fascinating guy, whether you love him or hate him, that Aleister Crowley. And it's been great talking with you about him tonight. Soraya, where do people find out about you? You've got a podcast and a radio show. So where do people find you online and learn more about what you do?
Well, as far as Where Did the Road Go, it's wheredidtheroadgo.com. We're on once a week. You've been on there four or five times now, I think. You've been on twice on the main show, and we do a midweek podcast with you once a month or so.
So I'm in the five-timers club, yes.
At least. I don't remember exactly how many times you've been on. And we're on Deprogrammed Radio, which is you can get to it off wheredidtheroadgo.com. And a guy named John runs that out of Spain, and it's a fantastic little radio station where you can get a whole bunch of other programming as well. And we're on Dark Matter Radio, which is off Art Bell's site. And we're almost up to a year worth of shows. We started at the end of January. You can also find some other stuff on the site. I have a whole bunch of blog entries of stuff I've written. I am working on a book covering all my different experiences, which we've gotten to very, very little of in this time.
And there's a book
up there I made as well.
We'll certainly have to have you back so that we can get into some more of that. Although, you know, I think you're beyond the point of being able to get rid of me as it is, so...
Someone die on a mountain with Crowley, someone asks in the chat room, and I believe there might have been a mountain climbing accident at some point.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that, but I did know he was a mountain climber. Are you, by the way, are you a mountain climber as well?
No, not even slightly.
No. I enjoy mountain climbing. I'm just not the kind of guy who goes rappelling off a 400-foot drop. So, ladies and gentlemen, Soraya Azcath, yet again, sir, a fascinating discussion. We're going to have you back and spend some more time digging into your strange life. And, of course, as always, keep us up to date on what's going on with you, and I'm sure I'll catch you again here sometime soon, my friend.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Micah.
It's been my pleasure. And again, hope to have you back sometime. You have a wonderful holiday season. Whatever it is you celebrate in the realm of a chaos magician, I hope it's good for you, okay?
Thanks.
Take care, my friend. That is Soraya Azcath and his podcast and radio program, Where Did the Road Go? Fascinating stuff. And, of course, it's always interesting to talk about the most vile and wicked man who ever was known to exist, although I've debated in my own mind whether exactly Aleister really was as bad as he was made out to be. Certainly controversial. I don't know. Do you think that Soraya was as controversial as Aleister Crowley, or even as controversial as I made him out to be? All-around good guy. Hard for him to be too controversial, huh? We'll wrap things up when we come back here on the Graylian Report. Broadcasting from the dark heart of Appalachia, I am Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report on a particularly creepy evening where we resolve matters at hand here in the bunker. It's just been creepy here in the bunker. Maybe it had something to do with having Soraya on the program, but I'll tell you this. I happen to know him pretty well, and he's a very big-hearted guy. One of our listeners just sent me a text message via the bunker text, and he says of Mr. Azcath, "That guy you had on might truly be a wizard." I think so, too, probably. Wrapping things up, I thought I'd end on a creepy note, since I was talking about how creepy things have been in the bunker tonight. You ever hear that old expression, out of the mouths of babes, though the things that kids say, you know? You hear that expression in similar renditions of that. And I've got a friend whose young boy had once told his parents that there was a creepy man that would hang around out the back window in the back of their house. And so I had found this story particularly unsettling, and so I'd gone to the boy and talked to him one time, and when I went over to visit, I'd said, "So how you been doing?" You know, I tried not to lead the discussion, but I got him to talk about this individual. I was a little concerned, I think, as anyone might have been, that, oh, is there somebody looking in the windows at night? And as he described this guy, it was funny because, I mean, he was obviously describing something he had maybe seen on television or in a film. But from time to time, kids do say kind of creepy things. And on a recent Reddit page, there had been a list of creepy things that kids say. It's one of those, but this has to do with the disturbing things that kids have said specifically when talking about their imaginary friends. Well, we've got a couple of minutes, so I'm going to go through a couple of these. One was, my son from the age of 3 always tells me that there was a creeper man who lived in my mom and dad's bedroom. Now, he brings it up after he visits them. I made the mistake once of asking what the creeper man looks like. My son said, "Oh, he doesn't have a face." Another one, when my daughter was 3, she had an imaginary friend named Kelly who lived in her closet. Now, Kelly sat in a little rocking chair while she slept and played with her, etc. Typical imaginary friend. Now, anyway, fast forward 2 years later. The wife and I are watching the new Amityville horror film, the one with Ryan Reynolds. And our daughter walks out right when the dead girl goes all black-eyed. Far from being disturbed, she says, "That looks like Kelly." "Kelly who?" we said. "You know, the dead girl that used to live in my closet." There's another one. A parent of one of my students told us in a meeting that she was concerned because her son, who was 7 years old at the time, talked about an invisible ghost who would walk and talk to him and would play with him in his room. Now, he said that the ghost was called the Captain and was an old white guy with a beard. The kid would tell his mom that the Captain told him when he grows up his job will be to kill people. And the Captain would tell him who needed to be killed. Gosh. But apparently the Captain tells him he doesn't have a choice and that he'll get used to killing people after a while. This next one reads, when my boy was 4, his imaginary friend would sit in the corner of the room. When you switched off the lights and the light... Let's see. When you switched off the lights, the light of red glowing eyes would apparently light up the room. Okay. Interesting. It's kind of strange when some of these people who post these things can't really write very well themselves. My little brother's imaginary friend Roger lived under our coffee table. Roger had a wife and 9 kids. Roger and his family lived peacefully alongside us for 3 years. One day, my little brother announced that Roger wouldn't be around anymore since he shot and killed him with his whole family. I don't know if he remembers any of this, but his genuine lack of remorse was very disturbing. This is the kid who apparently shot and killed Roger the ghost, or imaginary friend, rather. My daughter used to tell me about a man who came into her room every night and put the sign of the cross on her forehead. I thought it was just a dream, and then my mother-in-law sent me some family photos. My daughter looked right at the picture of my husband's father, who had been dead for 16 years, and said, "That's the man who comes into my room at night." My husband later told me his father would always do the sign of the cross on his forehead when he was young. This will be the last one for the evening. When my older daughter was 2 or 3, she used to have a couple of imaginary friends. She called them Dodo and Dee Dee. They were typical imaginary friends. She would talk to them and play with them and tell me about their lives. Well, then one day, when she was about 3, she was talking on her little play phone. And then I walked into the room, and she hung up on her phone and said to me, with a completely flat voice and deadpan expression, she looks at me and she says, "Dad, the evil is coming. The evil is coming." Well, it scared the hell out of me. She seriously had an imaginary friend named the evil. Turns out the evil was actually a pretty nice friend. She just had an unfortunate name. The evil? Are you kidding me? Out of the mouths of babes indeed. Now, have you ever experienced this yourself? If any of you in the Graylian listening audience have ever had strange things that your kids have told you, whether it be about an imaginary friend or anything else, I'd be interested in hearing about it. You can email me directly, info@graylianreport.com. That's GRAILIEN report.com. The home on the web of our program. And until next time, my friends, as always, I bid you adieu on behalf of Micah Hanks himself, sitting here talking into the microphone, as well as Tyler Pittman, Caleb Hanks, Matthew Oakley, Dick Oakley, and John Anderson. Have a fantastic holiday season. Stay tuned. We're going to have some updates about what we're going to do for our year-end roundup. It's going to be a good time no matter what we do. Stay strange, my friends. I'm the Mouth of the South, and we'll talk to you next time.
Been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website GraylianReport.com.